Sorry.
No.
That's refreshing. Thank you. Forgot the substitution.
Thanks. All right, the next matter on for oral argument is in the matter of the welfare of the child of SDT and SR parents. Counsel, each of you will have 15 minutes to present your arguments, and with an additional 5 for appellant's counsel to use for rebuttal if you choose. The timing restrictions are indicated in the podium, and also there's a button that you're fully aware of that you can elevate or lower the lectern to match your height. Please state your name as you commence each leg of your argument, because we keep track of those things in our audio recording of the proceedings. Counsel for appellant.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Peter Gorman of the Hennepin County Public Defender. Are we turned up, Ms. Marshall? And I'm here representing the appellant.
Lost your windbreak. You can take a moment to put that back on. It might prevent any popping sound.
I'd have to charge it.
I've never seen this happen before.
We won't start your clock until you...
I understand there was an oral argument in Washington where Justice Blackmun was giving instructions about how to raise and lower the podium, but I've never seen this happen. Well, I'm representing Mr. Richard Strickland, who is the appellant in this matter. The standard of review on the legal issues is de novo, and I apply that to the federal and state law issues that I've raised, as well as the issue about termination due to cognitive disability. The standard of review for the third claim is abuse of discretion. Now, this is the fourth case, fourth case that the two of you have heard. I'm not going to stand here and repeat what's in the brief. I'd like to make a few brief points before I sit down. The first point that I'd like to make is that it was error to rush this case to an expedited TPR petition and trial. And in doing so, the agency deprived Mr. Strickland of time to engage in rehabilitative programming.
Can I ask you some big picture questions about your argument, just so I understand the framing?
Yes, sir.
So I wasn't clear on the argument that you're making. Well, first let me ask a procedural question. I see the reference to the Rehabilitative Act and Minnesota's Human Rights Act on appeal. When was the first pleading in which those two statutes were presented, either in the district court or on appeal?
I don't think the Human Rights Act was pleaded. I think someone gave me a tip about that statute while I was preparing the brief.
Okay.
I don't think I knew about it in advance.
Fair enough. What about so it doesn't show up until appeal? The district court was never presented with the Minnesota Human Rights Act argument?
You know, trial counsel is here, but I don't think that the Chapter 363, I think, issue was raised.
What about the Federal Rehabilitation Act?
Now, the ADA and the Rehabilitation Act of 73 are both read in tandem. The ADA was enacted to strengthen the provisions of the Rehabilitative Act of 73. And if you look at the cases that interpret these, they all interpret the two statutes in tandem as if they were one part of the other. And their implementing regulations both say the regulations for implementing the ADA are the same as the ones under the Rehab Act. The regulations under the Rehab Act say the standards for interpreting are the same as the ADA. So therefore, in Mr. Strickland's counsel's opening argument, where she referred to the ADA, I think we can also credit her with referring to the Rehabilitation
Act. Is there a case that in federal court or otherwise that indicates that a claim made, an assertion made under the ADA is necessarily implicating the Rehabilitation Act if it's not specifically?
I ran across a Hawaii case, not the one that's cited in the brief, but I did see a Hawaii case that said exactly that. And perhaps after my argument, I can find
sure.
it my to next give, you, give next, you a cite.
Next big picture question. I don't want to eat up too much of your time with these, but I just want to understand.
Okay.
So you're I'm unclear whether you're making the argument that the ADA was violated and therefore there is a remedy under the ADA, or whether the state termination of parental rights statute incorporates the reasonableness requirements under the ADA. In other words, that reasonable efforts necessarily includes reasonable accommodations when you have someone with a disability. Can you explain which of those two?
Sure.
Or maybe you have a different argument altogether you're making.
I tried to address that in the reply brief, but if I didn't do that adequately, I apologize. I am not claiming that the ADA is a defense on the merits. That's what the state said. That's what the agency said in their brief that I was doing in the blue brief.
So you're not saying the ADA was violated, therefore there can be no termination?
I'm saying that if the agency did not offer regulations in keeping with this gentleman's disabilities, then it violated the ADA and the termination must be reversed, but not in the sense of it being a defense. You know, there's about...
Explain that to me.
Yeah, I don't.
Okay.
That's what I need.
There's about 30 cases that I think I read in preparing this. About 10 of them say, under no circumstances is the ADA a defense on the merits, and including some of the cases that I've cited say
that. So in those cases, you can't even look to the ADA to define what reasonable efforts would be or what services that might be provided?
No, you can't reach that conclusion, because some of the very same cases that say that the ADA is not a defense on the merits also say that the ADA requires a provision of efforts, and if they don't require a provision of efforts, then the TPR can be reversed.
Okay, that's where I'm lost. I mean, I haven't seen a holding like that in Minnesota.
You don't have a holding.
Right. When I look at the ADA, it expressly says that individuals look to certain provisions within the ADA for remedies, procedures, for violations of the ADA. So if a violation of the ADA directs individuals exactly to what procedures are afforded for violations or what rights,
the regulations
what remedies
do.
The regulations do. So I'm wondering how it is, if the ADA does not identify a defense in a state proceeding as a remedy to an ADA violation, how the logical leap is made from the ADA to the application of temporary.
The logical leap is that the cases say that even though it's not a defense on the merits, like self-defense would be a defense to murder, that these cases say the ADA requires the state to offer a certain level of efforts, and if it's customary efforts, like in ours under 260.012, are not specialized to the gentleman's disability, then the ADA is violated.
Right, but then the ADA says these are the remedies if the ADA is violated. And the remedies are certain remedies that are defined in the ADA and certain procedures that are identified in the ADA. And so I'm trying to get a sense of how, even if there was a violation of the ADA, how do you get from there to, how is the ADA incorporated either implicitly, expressly, indirectly, directly into our termination of parental rights statute, and that's where I'm lost in your argument.
You know, I'm really sorry that I haven't made that.
No, it's
clear.
Not. I mean, I it's
most of the
you
cases.
Don't have to apologize.
Most of the cases that find that efforts were insufficient, nevertheless, affirm as harmless. Like in criminal cases, you have a dozen criminal cases every Monday where you say that there was error, but it was harmless, so we're not going to reverse. I think that Michigan case that is discussed in the reply brief, I'm pretty sure that Michigan case reverses a TPR. It's called In re Hicks and Brown. Yes, Your Honor.
I have another big picture question. I think that's consistent with what we've been discussing. Could you address, how does the ADA and the Rehabilitation Act provide more protection for a parent than our typical reasonable efforts determination would?
Our position on that would be that the agency should have made more of an effort to ensure that those who were working with Mr. Strickland were thoroughly familiar with developmental disability and with cognitive disability. Ms. Van Oss, who was the first social worker...
Why do you need the ADA for that?
Pardon me?
I mean, I hear your argument, and it seems plausible, because there is a reasonable efforts requirement, and as I read the case law applying that, it has to take into account the circumstances of the parents. And if a circumstance of the parent is a developmental delay, it would seem to me that a reasonable efforts analysis has to include it. So why do we, I'm trying to get a sense of why the ADA is necessary, or doesn't the statute as it exists now in Minnesota already cover the issues that you're raising under the ADA?
The ADA and the subsequent federal statutes add to 260.012. As I said to you in the blue brief, after the Adoptions and Safe Families Act was passed under President Clinton in 1997, the legislature amended 260.012 to incorporate some of the regulations that were written under the Adoptions and Safe Families Act. The Adoptions and Safe Families Act is the third in a line of statutes, starting with the Rehab Act of 73, then to the ADA in 1990, then to the Adoptions and Safe Families Act of 1997. And all of them have implementing regulations, which I've cited to you in the blue brief and in the case of one or two of them, in the gray brief as well. So why does that supplement, why do we need the ADA, I think was your question. The answer that I give you is that given the nature of this gentleman's disabilities, we are charging the agency with a greater responsibility to ensure that the people who worked with him were familiar with his disabilities and how to get around it. And as I started to say a moment ago, Ms. Van Oss, who was the first child protection social worker, there isn't a word in the record about her specialization in working with people who are cognitively impaired or who are developmentally disabled or who have some of the other problems that Mr. Strickland had.
That wouldn't matter, would it, if Mr. Strickland had received all of the accommodations that you believe he was entitled to?
I think it does matter because these people are working with these clients.
How would your client be prejudiced at all if the efforts were reasonable? Even if the person who is providing the services or developing the case plan doesn't have the expertise that you're saying they should.
Look at Ms. Van Oss's testimony near the end of her time on the stand. She said, look, even if there was an error in not starting with a CHIPS case, we would have filed for termination by now anyhow. It seems to me that she should have had some specialty in working with developmentally disabled people. Now, Ms. Posthumous, there was something in the record that she did have that sort of training. But let's go back to the first parenting worker, Ms. Hurd from FamilyWise. There isn't a word in the record that she had any sort of specialization in working with developmental disability or in cognitive disability. Ms. Posthumous put out at great length what Mr. Strickland needed, notes, blackboards, short telephone calls, personal visits, a whole range of things. And she said she provided those. But we don't have anything in the record that the first FamilyWise worker who wrote a report saying, I've gone as far as I can with this guy, and we don't have anything in the record that Ms. Van Oss had that kind of training. We don't have anything in the record that the individual therapist who started with Mr. Strickland in July of 2018 had any of that specialization, and we don't have anything in the record that the ARMSH workers from Ramsey County had any of that specialization.
But didn't your client refuse those services, Mr. Gorman? I mean, after the county went to steps to get him qualified for the ARMS services, he said he didn't need it, and he discontinued it. So
that's the only one out of the five or six services that he accepted.
Right, but wouldn't the armed services have gotten to many of those issues that you're claiming were lacking that are lacking because of his refusal to accept the need for those? Or
this is only the second case where I've had arms agency involvement. I really don't know what they do. Mm-hmm. The last person that I brought here, she was mentally ill. She was not cognitively disabled. But that's the only one that he didn't do. Mm-hmm. He did the psychological, he did the parenting, he did two parenting classes, he was in individual therapy, he visited, I'm probably forgetting something, But he did all these things. And as long as we're on that point, I want to point out to you that the trial judge's findings that he hadn't done any of the case plan, and those are findings 25, 26, 37, and 46, those are all clear error when he says that Mr. Strickland did not do any of his case plan. That's simply not the case. He did everything in the case plan as best he could and was still doing it at the time of trial.
Except for the psychological assessment.
No, he did the psychological. He did it early. He did the psychological, I think, was the first thing he did.
So here's a question. If we were to agree with you that the Rehabilitative Act applies, and the Rehabilitative Act has a triggering moment, which is a request for services, a request for accommodations, your brief goes on at length about whether he should have been afforded a neuropsychological assessment, and he was never offered that.
That's a huge failing.
I see that you're saying that, but when was the first time that anyone in the state was aware that that is a request that your client was making for an accommodation?
Our position on that point is that they should have offered it. Posthumous.
But as a matter of procedure, is it true what the respondent is saying, which is that this was not presented to anyone? It was only offered as an argument by counsel at the termination trial.
They should have done it. That's the position.
But as a matter of fact, is that accurate?
And they should have done the adaptive functioning test. These are things.
But as a matter of fact, I just want to know whether it's accurate that this first came up as an argument by counsel at trial.
I believe it was in the closing argument, and it was in the cross-examination of Ms. Posthumous, and it may have been in the cross-examination of Ms. Van Oss. I don't recall that.
Yes, your time has expired, but Judge Larkin
has a quick question, just so I'm clear on the last answer. Short answer. Did your client's attorney at any point in the proceedings prior to trial say the case plan needs to include a neuropsych, the case plan needs to include adaptive testing, I want those services provided?
I don't know the answer to that question. And from your prior practice in our court, I'm sure you remember that a lot of times these case plans are adopted and we don't have anything to say about it.
But I'm also, I think there is case law that raises the concern that, you know, it's difficult to complain that efforts weren't reasonable if the parent sort of goes along with the case plan and never requests additional services.
Well, you know, that goes to my point that I've already made. I'm sorry for going beyond time. That goes to the point that I've already made about this being a voluntary case plan. This was not court ordered. It is a total misnomer to call this a court ordered case plan. It was approved by the court under 260C.178. But it was not court ordered.
Because there was never a CHIPS finding that would have led
to a
dispositional order with a court ordered case plan.
I prepared a nice outline about how they could have done this case differently, and maybe I'll be able to say a word or two on the rebuttal argument about that. But no, there wasn't a CHIPS finding.
Thank you, Mr. Gorman. You will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Counsel for the county.
Good morning, and may it please the court. I am Lisa Godin, Assistant Hennepin County Attorney, appearing today on behalf of the respondent, Hennepin County Human Services and Public Health Department, which I'll refer to as the department. In our view, there are two issues, essentially, that are presented in this appeal. First, whether the trial court properly found that the department made reasonable efforts to reunify appellant with his child, and whether its efforts complied with applicable law. And secondly, whether the trial court properly terminated appellant's parental rights under the statutory grounds that formed a basis for termination. Because the trial court's findings with regard to the department's reasonable efforts and three independent statutory bases for termination of appellant's parental rights were supported by clear and convincing evidence, the termination of appellant's parental rights should be affirmed.
Can I take you to the second part of the issue, aside from the arguments about the Americans with Disabilities Act and the Rehabilitative Act. I was struck, I'll tell you where I was a little bit stuck. and you can help me here. I was struck by the fact that a lot of the district court's decision and your argument on appeal is focused on the dad's failure to separate from mom, biological mom. And that's clearly part of the case plan, but paragraph 5, which is failure to correct the conditions that led to the child's placement, was not a basis for the district court's termination of parental rights. And so I was curious how that you think that fact factors into the three bases upon which the district court relied for termination.
Yes, Your Honor. The department did believe, and I was the trial attorney for the trial, did believe that the failure to comply with the case plan to the extent that Mr. Strickland had not was important to the analysis. It is important to the analysis with regard to Minnesota Statute 260C301, Subdivision 1B2, which is one of the grounds that was a basis for termination, that is failure to perform parental duties. There is case law that states that failure to comply with a case plan is ample evidence for termination under the ground of failure to perform parental duties.
Well, it depends on the circumstances of the failure to follow the case plan, doesn't it? I mean, in this case, it seems to me that the significant basis was dad's refusal to let go of the mother of the child who's mothered 9 children, none of whom she has parental rights over. And that there was this need to protect the child from this person. But I didn't see anything in the record that would indicate a need to protect the child from mom. I can see where her parental rights were terminated for not being a fit parent. But being an unfit parent doesn't necessarily make the person dangerous to be around the child, does it? And if it doesn't, what is there in the record that would substantiate this notion that that father's parental rights should be terminated for failure to separate from mom?
There, Your Honor, I do believe that there is evidence in the record about the risk that ST posed to this child. And we discussed that in our brief as well.
I didn't see anything in the district court's findings that would indicate that mom is a danger to the child, only that her parental rights have been terminated.
Well, Your Honor, the brief, and I know that the district court's decision also refers to this, respondent ST had she had cognitive disabilities similar to Mr. Strickland's cognitive disabilities. She also had a history of violent and aggressive behavior that the court cited. There were a couple of visits that were referenced in the district court's order in which, at the beginning of the case, both parents had supervised visits with the child. And at several of those visits, there were arguments between ST and appellant that led ultimately to the cessation of her visits with the child. They had to do with arguments between the two parents and then an argument with the visitation supervisor where the visit supervisor had to call security. There were instances in her past about domestic violence that she had experienced with a previous partner with whom she continued to live, at least according to what she testified during the course of this case, at least off and on. And she also had cognitive impairments and was not able to meet the needs of the children. But it was, I think, the greatest concern for the district court and for the department was that she had this explosive personality. She had untreated mental health conditions that she had not adequately remedied. And so the department did believe that she continued to pose a risk to the child. But that was not the only basis that the district court found for termination. It was certainly an important consideration, but also appellant's failure to benefit appreciably from the case plan that was narrowly tailored and suited to his needs.
I mean, I saw that argument, and it seemed to, I thought that I would find that as I read the different documents. I didn't go first to the district court's termination, but when I got there, I was surprised I didn't see paragraph 5 as a basis for the district court's decision. Was paragraph 5 asserted as a basis?
It was not, Your Honor, and I think that the reason was that the petition was drafted with ST in mind. She was the custodial parent of the child, and so the grounds that were pled when the petition was filed primarily pertained to her. We didn't, at the time that we filed the initial petition, we did not know who the child's father was, and then we ultimately came to know that it was Mr. Strickland. And so, that he had established paternity.
So once it was known that Mr. Strickland was involved and the issues were going to be largely about his cognitive deficiencies and his slow learning and the need for, if there's going to be any rehabilitation or reunification, things had to be delivered to him slowly. I'd like you to address Mr. Gorman's argument about the expedited nature of the proceedings and why it wouldn't be, without regard to the ADA, unreasonable to proceed in an expedited basis in a circumstance where it is known that the parents, in particular this parent, is low-functioning, slow, very slow learner, needs to be presented with things on a repetitive basis for him to learn. Making it, I think the argument is there's really no chance for him to succeed under a case plan that rushes things through. He can't learn fast enough. Can you respond to that without regard to the ADAs? Why is that not unreasonable?
Well, Your Honor, a couple of responses to that. The department and respondent does not agree that this case was rushed to finality. The case, Mr. Strickland had 11 months to work with the department and work on a case plan. 11 months is not an expedited rush to judgment with regard to him. And the department had the benefit of those 11 months in working with him to see how much he was able to improve his parenting skills after he received narrowly tailored specific services to address his disabilities, and he failed to appreciably benefit from them. He showed some improvements, and the department recognized, and the district court recognized this as well, that he loved his child, and he was able to provide his child with food. He had a home, but he was not able to respond to his child's higher level needs. He did not recognize those needs. He didn't have a primary care doctor identified in Minnesota for the child because he and the child's mother had sought medical care for the child only in Chicago, although they primarily, according to their testimony, lived in Minnesota during the 2.5 years before the department located the child. So he was not able, even though he had services provided to him, he was not able to make marked improvements in his parenting skills that would have necessitated the court continuing the case longer.
For which of the three bases that the district court relied upon to terminate parental rights here, would you say there is the most clear and convincing evidence in support?
Well, Your Honor, Respondent believes that all of these grounds are sufficient basis for termination. I would hate to have to choose one of these. We believe that there's ample evidence for all of them, but the arguments
Well,
for
I understand
all of
you
them,
believe there's, I mean, some are stronger than others, it seems to me, but looking at the language of each one of the provisions, which one do you think is most closely supported by the evidence?
Our arguments on all three are very similar, Your Honor. The arguments are that the two primary arguments are that he failed to separate from ST, the child's mother, who posed a danger to the child, and the district court found that his testimony was not credible, that he had in fact separated from her, and secondly, that he had not appreciably benefited from the case plan that was provided to him. Most importantly, he had not benefited from parenting education services enough that he could meet the child's emergent needs. For example, if the child had a medical emergency, his parenting educators did not believe that he would know how to respond to that.
I saw those two as the bases, and you've summarized what I saw too in the district court's analysis, that those were the two overarching elements. And so I look at paragraph 8, that the child is neglected and in foster care. And I don't see how those two factors really bear significantly in support of neglected and in foster care. It seemed to me that that the father was attending to his case plan, trying to interact with the child. Obviously, you had issues with mom and the conflict that led to some termination of their meeting with the child, visiting with the child. But since you believe they're all sort of equal, how do those two factors support that the child's neglected and in foster care?
Well, for that subdivision, which is 1B8, the child must be in foster care by court order, which the child was. The child cannot return home due to the parent's circumstances, condition, or conduct. In that case, the department argued, or the position of respondent was, that the child could not return home because of the ongoing relationship with ST, and because he had not he did not have the ability to respond to his child's needs. And then finally, the parents have failed to make reasonable efforts to change their circumstances, condition, or conduct. Appellant did, in fact, complete some assessments. He did the psychological assessment.
Right, but first, neglect in foster care. I mean, ordinarily, that is a dismissive attitude, a disconnect from the child while the child is in foster care. I know there's other elements the court looks to determine whether the statute is met, but was there, can you point to anything that fits the traditional understanding of neglecting and in foster care in this case by father?
The things that I would point to, Your Honor, are that he did not believe that either he or his child had any special needs that needed to be addressed. He did not know what services his child was receiving and did not believe his child should be, for example, in preschool. Did not believe his child needed any special services because he thought his child was smart and normal. And whereas the foster parents with whom the child was placed were actively seeking out those services for the child, preschool,
I understand how all of that suggests a parenting deficiency. I get that. I just don't understand how that is neglect. It appears he's not aware. He's got cognitive issues. But the idea of him when I look at the definition of neglect, his lack of understanding, even if he's faulted for that lack of understanding, seems to be distinguished from neglect while in foster care.
Well, and it's a little difficult to speculate on it, Your Honor, too, because the child was not in his care during the time that the case was open, the 11 months that the case was open. And in the 2.5 years before the case opened, it's not clear which of the parents was actually providing the primary care or if either of them was. According to his testimony, he and mother shared responsibilities 50-50. But, and in fact, yes, the child was still alive when he was located and appeared to be in fairly good health, although his needs had been neglected. He showed significant speech delays when he was found, and no services had been provided for him to address those, even though they had been recommended by his physicians in Chicago, and the parents had not located even a medical provider here in Minnesota for the child.
You don't have a lot of time left. I'd like you to address the overarching argument that at heart, what's really going on here is you have a low-functioning father with a very low IQ who doesn't comprehend things in the way that someone who's more is higher on the intelligence scale would merit. And that's really what's going on here. That's the underlying basis. Everything else sort of hangs on that. And that's the reason for termination.
Well, Your Honor, respectfully, I disagree with that. I mean, as I said, there were two bases for the termination, two primary bases, and one of them had to do with not being able to protect the child from the child's mother. The appellant was not particularly unique in child protection court. There are many parents who come in with cognitive disabilities that are not dissimilar to his. In fact, appellant had lived independently on his own in St. Paul for 13 years in the same apartment. He had never sought medical assistance for himself, but he had been able to manage. So he appeared on first blush to be fairly able to meet his needs. But then the department learned later on that he did have some cognitive issues that it needed to address and that it did address. So his rights were not terminated solely on the basis of his cognitive disabilities, and his cognitive disabilities were not so unique that they required any efforts other than those that were provided by the department in this case. We ask that this court affirm the termination.
I have one question. I wanted you to answer Judge Ross's questions, but I'm troubled by a little bit, by the fact that ST and appellant were grouped together from day one, but they were worlds apart in terms of procedure and posture. I mean, no reasonable efforts were required for her. They were for him. My question is this. What's the agency's legal justification under statute or rule or otherwise for not looking at him from the standpoint of a CHIPS petition as opposed to proceeding directly to termination?
Your Honor, in a way, I think that it's a little bit of it. That is a bit of an academic argument, because had there been a CHIPS petition filed, well, first off, he was not the custodial parent, so we would not have filed a CHIPS petition on him. ST was the custodial parent, and that's why we filed the petition that we did. Whether there had been a CHIPS petition filed initially or at any, well, we did file a CHIPS petition initially, but then later filed a termination petition when the child was located. But whether there had been a CHIPS petition on appellant or not, he would have had somewhere in the neighborhood of 11 to 12 months to work his case plan and make improvements. He was given 11 months to make improvements. While he did some things and the department recognized that he did, there were areas where he was still seriously deficient in his parenting abilities and his ability to meet his child's needs. And so proceeding by month 11 to trial was not extremely out of the ordinary. A few more months would not have helped, and the district court found that additional time would not have been helpful to remedy the deficiencies that he had as a parent.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Counselor Appellant. Rebuttal.
That button's a long way down. If there had been
the record, record will reflect that.
If there had been a CHIPS petition, the agency could have gotten a disposition order which said, stay away from ST. They didn't go for a CHIPS petition. They didn't go for a CHIPS disposition order staying away from ST. Instead, they brought a court progress report to Judge Hoyos and said, we'd like you to order him not to have any contact with ST. But Judge Hoyos had no jurisdiction over him at the time that was
brought. I've heard that argument, Mr. Grumman, but it seems a little circular to me, and I'm having a hard time following it, because on the one hand, you say, there was no court-ordered case plan, so you can't hold that against the appellant for not following it. Well, it seems to me the logical result of that is then if there's no court-ordered case plan, then there wasn't a need for one in it in any event. So what difference does it make?
I argued that in the opening pages of my brief, that there wasn't any need for a case plan. This guy was a total stranger to these people. They had no idea who he was. They ultimately found out he had no children. He had no child protection history. He was a complete stranger.
So under the facts, they were to just turn the child over to him? Under the facts that the child came into their custody in the 2.5 years that this order had been in place?
At the time they picked him up at the Walgreens in Bloomington, they had nothing on this guy. They thought that Strickland and ST had been hiding him. There's nothing in the record that says any proof as to whether Strickland and ST had been hiding him.
But at that point, they didn't even have proof that he was the legal father of the child.
Well, I think that that came pretty quickly. I'm pretty sure that Strickland said right away, this is my child, and ST said this was my child. But if they had done the CHIPS, they could have gotten an order for him to stay away. And then these findings about how Strickland won't stay away from ST would be supported by the record. But instead, it's a voluntary case plan, a voluntary provision to stay away from ST. He can't be terminated for his failure to stay away from ST because that wasn't a court order. Now, there were some questions about where in the record is there stuff about ST's dangerousness. There isn't any evidence in the record. All we have in the record is that there was a visitation at Family Wise at one point where ST and the visitation supervisor got into an argument because ST thought that the visitation supervisor was flirting with Mr. Strickland. That's the only thing. Now, my opponent here made a citation to testimony that was in ST's TPR trial. That's not part of the record on appeal. I never read that testimony. I wasn't at that trial. I don't know what transpired at that trial. But that's not part of the record here. We don't have anything about ST and her dangerousness. About the claim that he should have been terminated under subdivision 1B2, the trial judge cited the Simon case in support of terminating under 1B2 for failure to do a case plan. But the case plan in the Simon case was court-ordered. It was not voluntary. This case plan was voluntary.
Therefore, paragraph 5, you're saying, would never have applied.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear that.
Therefore, paragraph 5 never would have provided a basis for...
Paragraph 5 wouldn't provide... It wasn't pleaded, for one thing. And by the way...
No, I understand that.
That reminds me, I thought about that when you asked this question of the agency. In the TR case, which is cited in the second half of the brief, the Supreme Court says that failure to comply with a case plan is 1B5 material, not 1B4, not 1B2, not 1B8. We don't have 1B5 in this case. It wasn't pleaded, it wasn't found, and under the TR case, it seems to me the trial judge could not have terminated him for failure to comply not only with voluntary services, but with services when the theory for termination under 1B5 was not done. It seems to me that the ultimate evil here was rushing this case to trial without offering enough services, including those specialized in dealing with cognitive disability. Yes, sir.
Your brief on page 25 asserts that it's clear from testimony that Dad's disability, not his relationship with the mom, is the primary reason why his parental rights were terminated. You didn't cite to any testimony. I didn't see any finding by the district court that would tend to indicate that the district court's findings are consistent with your assertion. What are you pointing us to there?
I think that's a bit of an overstatement. Sorry to have to admit that.
All right, that's all right.
It's pretty obvious.
I appreciate your candor. That's fine.
That's in the second argument where I was saying they terminated him just because he was cognitively disabled. I think, had I been more careful with that sentence, I would have said the primary ground here is the relationship with ST, but that is their fault, not RS's, not Richard Strickland's fault, because they didn't seek a CHIPS. They didn't seek a court order directing him not to have contact. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you to both counsel for your argument, for your briefing and your oral argument. Matter is submitted. We'll issue our opinion within the statutory period. We appreciate it. Thank you. And that is our last case on our oral calendar, so we are in recess.